This episode is brought to you by the Master of Arts in Catholic Education program at the Augustine Institute Graduate School of Theology. Dedicated to the renewal of Catholic education, this degree equips school teachers and administrators to bring Christ to the center of every classroom through a focus on sacred scripture, theology, Christian anthropology, and the traditional liberal arts. Ephraim Radner is Professor Emeritus of Historical Theology at University of Toronto. He is the author of our back page column, so our First Things readers, all of you know his work very well, of course. And he has, of course, many books, including Time and the Word, Figural Reading of the Christian Scriptures, a commentary on Leviticus that I think you did with Rusty's series, and a new study entitled Mortal Goods, Reimagining Christian Political Duty. That's certainly a timely topic, and that's what we'll discuss today. Welcome, Professor Radner.
Thank you so much, Mark. Great to be here with you.
You open with an interesting observation, and that is that politics really springs from parenting. That children inspire political understanding. How does that work?
Well, yeah, you're right. The whole book actually came out of something I tried a few years ago, sort of very personally, to write a letter to my two young adult children and my son-in-law about what is a good life, and trying to share that with them, in part because, I don't know, I was getting older, they're getting older, I've been sick, all these questions about how long do we have with each other, what's important to share. And so I wrote this letter, which was more than a page. It was a number of pages. And subsequently felt that, they took it and they read it, and I got some feedback. But there was a sense that I got from them that it lacked a certain context. And that context had to do with our culture and our, if you will, political setting, in which a lot of the things I was trying to share with them really didn't make any sense outside of that context, or without recognizing the changing character of that context for all of us, trying to share these things was difficult to explain well. So I set about trying to think through how could I explain why the things I shared with them were so important? What were the presuppositions behind these good things I wanted to tell them I felt made up the good life that I wished for them and prayed for them? And that gave rise to the book, finally. At the end of the book, there is that letter, although I revised it in light of things I had thought about and read about and then wrote about. I revised it, but it's pretty much the same letter I sent them initially. But now placed, as I said, in this context, which I hope could help make sense of why these things were important. As I said, to say to your child, well, it'd be great if you could, you know, I think a good life is one in which you, as I said, in which you can be part of a family and recognize it and care for it and receive from it, whether that's your own children or a larger family and so on. For me to say that, in our day, one has to make an argument because it's no longer self-evident to many people. People don't get married, people don't want to have kids, don't have kids, and so on. And it makes no sense to a lot of people precisely because the culture, largely, or at least moved along by the political culture, has undermined these, our ability to see these as goods, let alone to promote them. So having, you know, children and politics go together, and they always have. And the book, it's not a book about children, but it that reality hovers behind it, and sometimes goes quite explicitly on the stage of the discussion.
Yeah, you mentioned that there is kind of a genre of what generational advice, right? To the at least over time, and part of your book, I think you would say, falls into that, although deeply into the theology behind good generational advice, certainly today, I don't think the young are getting much good generational advice these days. And as you go through, you know, one of the things, maybe is this the first fact that you would offer of your wisdom for the young, that they really are coming to maturity into a time that has some evil in it?
Yeah. So the sort of introductory chapter, not the introduction itself to the book, is about, in a way, a short history of giving advice, letters to children or treatises or what have you. Yeah. And as you point out, that has gone back to antiquity. People have always done that. That's one thing. And the second chapter is about the character of the days we live in. The notion, again, it goes back to certainly the New Testament explicitly. These are evil days we live in. One of the evils of our days is precisely the hiding, the obscuring, forgetting, even rejecting openly of generations as the framework in which we understand who we are as individuals. We are human beings because we exist generationally. That's it. We could go back to Adam and Eve and say, well, that's not true for them, but immediately it was true. Immediately. The whole of Scripture is laid out generationally. And I've written in the past about how important genealogies in the Bible are. And they're not just Old Testament matters. There's the old saw that, well, you know, the Old Testament, they were just interested in having children and patriarchy and so on and so forth. The New Testament, and the whole New Testament starts with a genealogical generation, a generational genealogy for Jesus. And there are two of them, and so on and so forth. We are human beings because God has placed us within this framework of being born to parents, being raised within a family, whether it's a good one or a bad one, a solid or a broken one, nonetheless, it's there. And for most people, not all, having children and trying to raise them and so on. And so much of our life is bound to this, what it means to love, what it means to hurt, what it means to sacrifice, what it means to be disappointed. You know, it's not an accident that psychotherapy grew up around talking about your parents and your children, and still does. That's what most people do. And I suppose in our era, we could say, yeah, well, there you go. Families are bad. They hurt us. And a lot of people believe that now. I mean, you get a lot of pushback against the kinds of things I'm talking about and pressing positively. By people who say, well, the fact that we have been located in generations and families is an evil in and of itself because it subjects us to the abuse that is so inherent in families. I think that's just nonsense. It's understandable from one perspective, but it's nonsense. The fact that family life can be traumatic and abusive in our psychotherapeutic understanding of our personalities is not a reason for saying that it's dispensable, just the opposite. It is sometimes traumatic and abusive precisely because we cannot escape it.
Right.
And everything about our life in its fundamental framework is inescapable. Well, that's another argument about mortality. Mortality is being created by God so that you don't control who you are. You come to be and you disappear from a biological standpoint and self-conscious standpoint, as we understand it, because of something outside of you. That is God, ultimately. And the inescapability of who we are, which goes to our family life, is part of the grace of being created. And it generates literally all the goods and the struggles and the richness and texture and sorrow as well as joy of our lives. That's what my letter to my children is about in the end.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that our culture has now explicitly attempted to destroy, in an attempt to escape, just these inevitable aspects of our limited existence. We don't want families. We don't want to die. We don't want relationships that are painful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. You in offering up the right posture for your children, for the young, generally, actually, you talk about, you know, certain responses, betterment and beatitude and distraction, but you go to Psalm 119, and there's a line that you make much of in that psalm: "I am a stranger in the earth." Is this a good posture, with at least with which to begin one's entry into the world?
I think it is, ultimately. I mean, partly it is, because it's who we are fundamentally. And that verse from Psalm 119 is not isolated. It comes up over and over again. And as I speak to, it has formed a major aspect of both Jewish and Christian self-understandings with respect to wandering in the wilderness as the place of primary joy with God, Feast of Tabernacles and so on in Israel's life and contemporary Judaism. And in Christianity, the notion of being, you know, our commonwealth is somewhere else, so that here we are strangers. Hebrews has a lot of that, chapter 11 and elsewhere. We're sojourners in the sense that we only, first of all, we're only here for a while.
Yeah.
Very little time. And we're sojourners in the sense also that we wander. We're never steady in our place, however much we think we have established a steady place. And the Psalms have a verse about that. I thought I was standing still, and then I fell. However much we think we have established things in a good way for ourselves, it's always undercut because of who we are, whether it's our own physical or emotional life, our illnesses, our business failures, our disappointments and stumblings, or that of those whom we love. So the sojourning isn't just about moving physically across a geographical landscape. It's also about the fact that we are wandering in the stability of our relationships and our sense of self. I have a chapter about being incomplete. It's sort of the more personal chapter in the book about my own life, elements of it. We are always incomplete in this sense. And that's partly the sojourner aspect as well, the strangeness. Nothing is put together in its final way in our life. That's because the final put togethering is God's, not ours. So it's an intrinsic reality.
Maybe we should jump to what I think you were referring to in your own personal life. Tell us about this episode in Burundi in the early 1980s when you were there, and sort of how does this apply to the bigger question? If you would like to tell us the story.
Sure, and I've told it before, so people are probably aware of it and bored of my repeating it. But nonetheless, it was deeply formative for my self-consciousness and thinking and responsiveness to the world. At age 24, I was ordained a deacon in the Episcopal Church, and I went to work as an appointed missionary in Burundi, which is a small country in East Central Africa, right south of Rwanda. The two are joined historically in many ways, positively and negatively. And I went to work teaching there. And this was 1981. And 9 years earlier, Burundi had a terrible civil war, more or less along ethnic lines, in which hundreds of thousands of people had been killed, in many cases massacred in singular acts. A lot of young people, especially murdered, thrown into Lake Tanganyika, disappeared completely. So I came on the scene as this young man to teach in a Bible college with, you know, I had 14 students, various ages, over half of them older than I was, who had been through this experience. Everybody in Burundi had been through this experience in the sense of being personally and usually horrendously touched by it. Somebody killed. I had a student who watched his parents being killed as he below him as he hid in a tree above, and so on and so forth, and watched his neighbors carry where, and he survived and had to go around watching his neighbor wear his father's coat, and so on and so forth. People were not allowed to talk about it. At this point, the government was run by a kind of military dictatorship, a code of silence, in an attempt to preserve things in a way, but also, keep people in their places. So I had to learn about the deep but hidden pain that people were carrying around with them. And I was this young American. I was a pretty liberal, not necessarily theologically, although certainly more so than today, but politically liberal American. I grew up in Berkeley in the 60s and early 70s.
You did?
Even though
were you born in the Bay Area, Ephraim?
No, I was born, but I was born elsewhere, but I moved there when I was moved there when I was 3 years old, so 2 years old. So basically,
I was in Berkeley in when I was 3 years old myself.
I don't know whether it shaped you or not. It shaped me, and I ended up on the conservative side, if you will, of all the upheavals. My siblings might take drugs. I wouldn't. My siblings might be involved in various behaviors. I refuse to. So I was conservative morally in that way, but it wasn't all that self-conscious. It's just who I was and some kind of deep response. But getting back to Burundi, I was a liberal in many ways, an American democracy. And in a democracy, you talk and you lay things out in the open so people can discuss them and so on and so forth. So this place in Burundi where everything was legally forbidden to be discussed, and crimes were hidden and forbidden to be laid out in the open, I instinctively and more and more chafed at this. I eventually wrote a little piece. It was the first thing I ever had published in the Christian Century about sort of the code of silence in Africa, in Burundi in particular, around these matters. And that it was killing people. I think in some sense you could say, in sort of a corporate psychological way, it wasn't good, it wasn't healthy. But somehow the government got hold of this article in the Christian Century, I don't know how, and it was viewed as subversive. I was arrested, interrogated, and then deported. All within 3 hours or 5 hours, put on a plane. And as I've described elsewhere, I lost everything that was important to me at the time.
Where did the plane go? Where were you sent?
Back to the U.S., to New York. It was the middle of January. It was freezing, and I was in a little short sleeve shirt and so on.
They actually packed you up. You couldn't take your belongings. You couldn't.
I could take a small suitcase. No, I lost most things, but the main thing I lost were my friendships, my colleagues.
Were you frightened? I mean, was it a horror, terrifying experience?
You know what happened, and I don't think I've ever made this clear anywhere in describing this story is. Because this goes to the chapter, I do speak about this, and it's all related. My family was a family that, in many ways, was deeply troubled. My mother had committed suicide when I was 18, 19. And one of my sisters, who had struggled with depression a long time, committed suicide the day before all this took place in Burundi. And the way they did it was they called me down. It's just bizarre. They called me. I lived up and worked in the mountains several hours outside of the capital. They called me, sent a message because there were no phones down, to come down to Bujumbura because I had an important call to get from my family. So I went down, and went to the church office where the treasurer had set up a phone call where I heard from my father that my sister had killed herself. At that point, the church treasurer who worked for the government said, and now, now the security agency requires your presence. And I was immediately taken there and interrogated and put on the plane. So it all happened. My sister's news of my sister's death and all of this happened all at once. So was I frightened? No, I was numbed.
In shock.
Yeah, in many ways. And now back to the book, though. As people who know a little bit about African history more recently know, you know, by 1994, so this was 1985, I was arrested and deported. 1994, everything fell apart in Burundi and then Rwanda. And we had the great genocides. Burundi then descended into 13 years of civil war, which probably killed an equal amount of people, if not close to it, over a longer period. And I felt, in response to all, here's the point. In response to all of this, I felt that I needed to make things right. You know, I needed to find a way to appeal to governments to do things, to help people do this and to do that. Basically, as I describe in the chapter, and it all is tied up in part as well with my own personal family life, I needed to find a way to save Burundi, save the church in Burundi, save my family, save people who suffer, save everybody. Now, I don't mean I had a savior complex in that sense, but I was driven deeply by a need which only over the years I've been able to identify, if not exactly escape, to find a way to finally, in some major way, eliminate the suffering of the world, which sounds like a good thing to do, doesn't it? I mean, we're trained to want to do that. We're told that's what it means, not just from a secular standpoint, but from a Christian standpoint.
Can we say minimize rather than eliminate?
Well, we can say that, but I think our deep goal, personally, is to eliminate it. Because, and this is where we get to this modern cultural, political now, phenomenon where mitigating suffering is no longer sufficient. This is where we get to the nadir of this whole culture of betterment, which is medically assisted suicide. We will end suffering because suffering has no place in the world, more morally speaking. The notion of palliative care, which is mitigative care, as being not just sufficient, but actually a good, that is, in a way, almost at least in earthly terms, a final good, is no longer acceptable. Indeed, it's considered either cowardly or abusive or what have you. The only thing that can finally grant us salvation in a secular sense is the end of all suffering. I think that is deadly to the soul because it's deadly to the gifts of God who has given us a life to live in relationship to others and ourselves, which is filled with the pain of loss and disappointment, which also is fueled and fuels, respectively, the joy of living in this world. We have turned into a culture of joylessness. And that's in part because we have become a culture which has no place for suffering as something to be not so much embraced, but engaged with a sense of purpose and hope and meaning.
You talk about sorrow as sort of inevitable in our lives. I mean, you You affirm, to get to your title, actually, that offering our, quote, mortal goods to God is the highest service, yet those offerings are always going to be, and this is your term, sorrowfully incomplete. Always going to be this way. And the idea, again, of there is no place for suffering in this world is, that can't be done except in a wholly different theological perspective than the one that you and I have.
I agree, and which is why in a world where suffering is something that needs to be banished, it can't be banished. And so what do we have? We have a culture, and you know, the book is sort of about politics. I mean, it is, but in this theological way, we have a political culture which is left with nothing but anger because suffering cannot be eliminated. If it can't be eliminated and offered to God in thanks. Now, you know, this is a hard thing to say, that I can thank. It's not so much that I thank God for my suffering, but I offer my suffering in thanks. Thank you, dear God, for making me and placing me in a place where love can be experienced and received and suffered. A political culture, which, as you said, has no place for that, and yet cannot stand to live with one's suffering, is one that will only be left with a kind of resentful anger. And here's where we've gone.
You know, you talk at one point that we do hear a great deal about the common good, about making our society better. But in truth, that talk always comes down to just very specific individual choices. That's the framing. I mean, talking about the big picture, but always getting down to the individual. Is this a problem?
Sure, it's a problem. And one of it has to do with proportion. If I am the end of all things in let's say my social life, then obviously my social engagements are going to be measured by only what I feel. And since what I feel is always incomplete and disappointed, the whole of my social engagements, as you just said, are incomplete and will tumble. Part of the book's central political argument is to understand the proportions in which our attempts to engage our social lives, social good. I don't actually talk about the social good that much because I think it's actually a kind of a deceptive claim, but I don't go into that. Part of the best way to do that is to understand that proportionately there's only so much, and it's actually very little, that we will ever be able to accomplish in reframing the whole of our society and our place within it. Proportionately, the whole thing is incomplete. And therefore, our goal should be the proper ordering of our concerns, which are, as you said, in the large picture, to offer our mortal goods, which are our lives, our children, our families, our survivals, our joys and sufferings, and engagements in these very small ways, which are constantly being rejigged and challenged, to offer that to God. It can't be done when the whole of our efforts are expended at completely redoing society, and because that's the, as you said, the projection of our hopes to completely redo ourselves. Can't be done. And what we do is we bring more sorrow upon us in this. That's a sub theme of the book's social argument. Our attempts to make things better almost always make things worse. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to mitigate, as you said, to have modest efforts at fixing this and that and so on. But we can't redo the world. This attempt to redo the mortal world is not just Promethean in this larger literary sense. It's not just hubris. It's folly.
It's dangerous. I think these people scare me, Ephraim. So the book is, there's much more in the book, but for now, the title is Moral Goods, Reimagining Christian Political Duty. Professor Radner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, Mark.